All right, let's talk about one of the most brilliant, challenging, and frankly mind-bending philosophers in human history. And here's the thing, most of you have probably never heard of him. But if you've ever questioned whether anything really exists the way you think it does, if you've ever wondered whether the self you carry around is actually real, or if you've ever felt like reality might be more fluid than solid, well, you're walking in Nagarjuna's footsteps. Look at this title, The Philosophy of Nagarjuna. The Middle Way of Emptiness. Now, I know what you're thinking. Emptiness sounds depressing, maybe even nihilistic. But hold on. This is where we need to slow down and be really careful, because this is one of the most misunderstood concepts in all of philosophy. Nagarjuna isn't teaching us that nothing matters or that everything is meaningless. That would be too easy, and frankly, intellectually lazy. What he's doing is far more radical. He's challenging the very foundations of how we think about existence itself. He's asking, what if everything you believe about how things exist is fundamentally mistaken? This subtitle, Exploring the Profound Teachings of One of Buddhism's Most Influential Thinkers, that word profound isn't just marketing hype. We're talking about ideas that shaped entire civilizations, that influenced how millions of people understood reality, consciousness, and liberation from suffering. And the wild part? These ideas are as relevant today as they were 1800 years ago. Now here's where we hit our first problem. We don't actually know that much about Nagarjuna the person. Look at these dates, circa 150-250 CE. That circa is doing a lot of work there. We're talking about southern India probably during a period when Buddhism was evolving, fragmenting, debating itself. But the historical details? They're frustratingly sparse. What we do know, and this is crucial, is that he's called the second Buddha. Think about that for a moment. In a tradition that reveres the Buddha as the awakened one, the enlightened teacher, someone comes along 600 or 700 years later and earns the title Second Buddha. That's not a participation trophy. That's recognition that this person fundamentally transformed how Buddhism understood itself. He founded the Madhyamaka school, and we'll come back to what Madhyamaka means, but for now, just know it means middle way. And this school didn't just influence one branch of Buddhism. We're talking about Tibet, China, Korea, Japan, intellectual frameworks that are still being studied, debated, and practiced today. But here's what I find fascinating. Most of what we know about Nagarjuna's life is legend, stories, hagiography. And you know what? That's actually kind of perfect for a philosopher who's going to teach us that our concepts of fixed identity and permanent essence are illusions. Even Nagarjuna himself resists being pinned down into a neat biographical box. The irony isn't lost on me. We're about to study a philosopher who questions the very nature of existence, and we can't even definitively say when or where he existed. But that's philosophy for you. Sometimes the questions are more valuable than the answers. What we do have, and this is what matters, is his work, his arguments, his devastating logical precision. And over the next several slides, we're going to see exactly why this monk from southern India earned the title Second Buddha, and why his ideas continue to challenge, provoke, and transform how we think about reality itself. So buckle up, we're about to question everything. Alright, so if we don't have much biographical detail about Nagarjuna, what do we have? We have this, the Mula Madhyamaka Karika. And I want you to try saying that 3 times fast. But seriously, this title matters. Fundamental verses on the middle way. Let's break that down. Fundamental. This isn't commentary, this isn't introduction, this is foundational. Verses, we're talking poetry, philosophical poetry, compressed, precise, devastating in its economy. And middle way. There's that term again, and we're going to see exactly what it means to walk between extremes. 27 chapters. Now that might not sound like much, but here's the thing. These aren't casual reflections. Each chapter is a surgical strike on a different aspect of what we think we know about reality. Causation. Motion, time, the self, nirvana. One by one, Nagarjuna takes our most basic assumptions and, well, let's just say he doesn't leave them intact. Look at this description. Systematic logical analysis and dialectical reasoning. This is important. Nagarjuna isn't asking you to take anything on faith. He's not saying, trust me, reality is empty. He's saying, let's reason this through together and watch what happens to your assumptions when we apply rigorous logic to them. And this is what makes him so dangerous, philosophically speaking. He's using the tools of rational argument, the very tools that philosophers love, that we trust, and he's turning them against our most cherished beliefs about existence itself. It's like watching a master chess player who knows the rules better than anyone else and uses that knowledge to show you that the game you thought you were playing, you weren't actually playing it at all. The impact? Central to Madhyamaka thought and Buddhist philosophy worldwide. We're talking about a text that's been studied, memorized, debated, and commented on for nearly 2,000 years. Scholars in Tibet spend years just on these verses. Zen masters in Japan reference them. This isn't just historical curiosity, this is living philosophy. And now we come to it. Shunyata, emptiness. And I need you to forget everything you think that word means. Look at this first point, not nothingness. I'm going to say that again, not nothingness. This is perhaps the most misunderstood concept in Buddhist philosophy, and honestly the confusion is understandable. We hear emptiness and we think void, nothing, absence of everything. But that's not what Nagarjuna means at all. Here's what emptiness actually means. The absence of independent, intrinsic existence. Things lack a fixed, unchanging essence that exists in isolation. Let me give you an example. Look at this table in front of me. Common sense says, that's a table, it exists, it's solid, it's real. And Nagarjuna would say, okay, but what makes it a table? Well, it's wood. But the wood came from a tree. The tree came from a seed. The seed needed soil, water, sunlight. The concept of table exists in human minds and cultures. The atoms that make up the wood are mostly empty space held together by forces we can't see. The tableness of this table, where exactly is it? Can you point to it? Can you find the essence of table that exists independently of all these conditions? That's emptiness. Not that the table doesn't exist. You can bang your knee on it, trust me. But that it doesn't exist in the way we normally think it does. It doesn't have some fixed, unchanging essence called tableness that exists on its own. Now look at the second point. Dependent arising. This is the flip side of emptiness, and this is where it gets really interesting. All phenomena arise dependently through causes and conditions. They exist only in relation to other phenomena, never independently. Do you see what this means? Everything, and I mean everything, exists only in relationship. The table exists because of the tree, the carpenter, the concept in human minds, the forces holding atoms together, the person perceiving it. Remove any of these conditions, and you don't have a table anymore. The table is nothing but this web of relationships. And here's where your mind should start bending a little. This applies to everything. Your body? A collection of cells that are constantly dying and being replaced, made of food you ate, water you drank, air you breathed. Your thoughts, arising from brain chemistry, past experiences, cultural conditioning, language you learned, yourself. We'll get there, but you see where this is going. Third point, challenging assumptions. This insight challenges notions of stable substances, fixed self-identity, and absolute categories. Everything we take for granted, that things have essences, that we have a permanent self, that categories like good and bad are absolute, all of it starts to dissolve under this analysis. And you might be thinking, okay, that sounds terrifying. And yeah, it can be. But look at the fourth point, revealing interconnection. Emptiness reveals the profound interconnectedness and interdependence of all things. It dissolves artificial boundaries we construct. And this is where emptiness becomes liberating rather than nihilistic. If nothing exists independently, then everything is connected to everything else. You're not a separate, isolated self struggling alone in an indifferent universe. You're a node in an infinite web of relationships. Your existence depends on countless other beings and conditions. Their existence depends on you. That's not nothing. That's not meaningless. That's the opposite of meaningless. It means everything matters because everything is connected to everything else. And that is what Nagarjuna means by emptiness. Now, I know your head might be spinning a bit. Good. That means you're actually engaging with this, because we're just getting started. Next, we're going to look at how Nagarjuna develops this insight through his analysis of dependent origination. And trust me, it gets even more interesting. Okay, so we've established what emptiness means, or at least started to wrap our heads around it. Now we need to understand the mechanism, the actual process by which things exist without having independent existence. And that's where Pratyasamutpada comes in. Dependent origination. And yes, I know, Sanskrit is not exactly user-friendly. But stick with me because this concept is absolutely central to understanding Nagarjuna's entire philosophical project. Look at the first point, conditioned existence. Everything exists only through a vast web of causes and conditions. Nothing possesses the power to bring itself into being independently. Think about that for a moment. Nothing brings itself into existence. Not you, not me, not this room, not thoughts, not feelings, not atoms, not galaxies. Everything that exists does so because of something else, or rather, because of countless other things. You exist because your parents existed. They existed because their parents existed. But it's not just biological. You exist as you because of language, culture, education, experiences, the food you've eaten, the air you've breathed, the books you've read, the conversations you've had. Remove any of these conditions, and you'd be different. Remove enough of them, and you wouldn't exist at all. But here's where Nagarjuna gets really interesting. Look at point two. No first cause. There is no uncaused first cause or independent entity that exists entirely on its own. Causation extends infinitely. Now, this is a direct challenge to a lot of philosophical and theological traditions. The Greeks loved the idea of the unmoved mover, something that causes everything else but is itself uncaused. Many religious traditions posit a creator god who exists independently and brings everything else into being. Nagarjuna says, no, show me this first cause. If it exists, what caused it? If you say nothing caused it, it just exists, then you've abandoned your own principle that everything needs a cause. If you say it caused itself, that's logically incoherent. How can something act before it exists? And if you say it's eternal and unchanging, then how does it cause anything? Causation requires change. Action. Time. Do you see the trap? Every attempt to establish an independent first cause collapses under logical scrutiny. Causation extends infinitely backward. Not because there was literally an infinite past, that's a different question, but because every cause is itself an effect of prior causes. There's no ground floor. There's no foundation. It's causes and conditions all the way down. Now look at point three. Beyond linear logic. His analysis reveals that causation is neither simply linear nor absolute. Causes and effects arise together in mutual dependence. Okay, this is where it gets really wild. We normally think of causation as linear, right? A cause is B, B causes C, C causes D. Simple chain. But Nagarjuna shows that even this is too simplistic. Think about it. Can you have a cause without an effect? If something doesn't produce an effect, was it really a cause? And can you have an effect without a cause? If something wasn't produced by anything, is it really an effect? The very concepts of cause and effect depend on each other. They arise together. They're mutually defining. A parent is only a parent because they have a child. A child is only a child because they have a parent. Neither identity exists independently. They arise together in mutual dependence. And this applies to causation itself. Causes and effects don't exist as separate, independent things that happen to interact. They're relational concepts that only make sense together. And here's the fourth point, and this is crucial. Path to liberation. Understanding this profound interconnectedness breaks our attachment to false views and fixed concepts, opening the door to freedom from suffering. Because here's the thing. And this is where philosophy becomes practical, where it becomes about how you actually live your life. Most of our suffering comes from clinging. We cling to ideas of permanence in an impermanent world. We cling to ideas of independence when everything is interdependent. We cling to fixed identities. I am this kind of person. This is who I am. When those identities are themselves empty of inherent existence. When you really understand dependent origination. When you see that nothing exists independently. That everything is in flux. That all identities are relational and conditional. You can't cling the same way anymore. It's like trying to grab water. And when the clinging loosens, suffering loosens with it. Now let's talk about what Nagarjuna is arguing against. Because to really understand his position, you need to understand what he's rejecting. Challenging all essences. Nagarjuna rejects both Brahminical and Buddhist views that posit permanent essences or unchanging substances underlying reality. So here's the context. In Nagarjuna's time, there were basically two major philosophical camps in India. You had the Brahminical traditions, what we might call Hindu philosophy, which talked about Brahman, this ultimate reality, this unchanging substance underlying all appearances. And you had certain Buddhist schools, the Abhidharma schools, which had developed incredibly sophisticated analyses of reality into fundamental constituents called dharmas. Both camps, despite their differences, shared an assumption that beneath the flux of appearances, there must be something permanent, something unchanging, something with its own inherent nature. The Brahminical thinkers said it was Brahman or Atman. The Abhidharma Buddhists said it was these fundamental dharmas, irreducible elements of existence. Nagarjuna says, "You're both wrong." And here's how I'm going to prove it. Look at point two. The method of analysis. Using reductio ad absurdum arguments with devastating precision, he demonstrates that concepts like self, cause, and effect are themselves empty of inherent nature. This is philosophical judo at its finest. Nagarjuna takes his opponent's own arguments, their own logical principles, and shows that they lead to contradictions. He doesn't need to introduce new premises or appeal to mystical insight. He just follows their logic to its conclusion and watches it collapse. For example, take the concept of self. If the self is permanent and unchanging, how can it experience anything? Experience requires change. You go from not knowing something to knowing it, from not feeling something to feeling it. But if the self changes, how is it permanent? And if it doesn't change, how can it be you? Because you're constantly changing, learning, growing, aging. Or take causation. If a cause produces an effect, does the effect exist in the cause or not? If it already exists in the cause, then it's not really being produced. It was already there. If it doesn't exist in the cause, then how can the cause produce it? How can something give rise to something completely different from itself? These aren't just word games. These are fundamental logical problems with the idea that things have fixed independent essences. Point 3. Exposing contradictions. His logical analysis reveals internal contradictions in essentialist views, showing how they collapse under rigorous scrutiny. Every attempt to establish a permanent substance, an unchanging essence, a first cause, a fixed self, all of them fall apart when you examine them carefully. Not because Nagarjuna is being unfair or using tricks, but because these concepts genuinely are incoherent when pushed to their logical conclusions. And look at point 4, opening liberation. By dissolving fixed identities and dualities, this critique opens the path to liberation from the suffering caused by clinging to false certainties. Because here's what Nagarjuna understands. We suffer because we cling to things that can't be clung to. We try to make permanent what is impermanent. We try to make independent what is interdependent. We try to fix what is fluid. And that creates a fundamental tension, a fundamental dissatisfaction with reality as it actually is. When you see through the illusion of fixed essences, when you understand that everything is empty of inherent existence, you're not left with nothing. You're left with reality as it actually is. Dynamic, interconnected, constantly arising and passing away in dependence on conditions. And there's a freedom in that, a lightness, because you're no longer fighting against the nature of things. You're no longer trying to be a permanent, independent self in a world where no such thing exists. You can just be in relationship, in flux, in the vast web of dependent origination. And that is why Nagarjuna's critique isn't just destructive. It's liberating. He's not tearing down your worldview to leave you in despair. He's tearing down the walls of your conceptual prison. All right, so we've deconstructed everything. We've shown that things don't have independent existence, that essences are illusory, that causation is more complex than we thought. And you might be sitting there thinking, okay, Professor, so what? Where does this leave us? If nothing has inherent existence, does that mean nothing exists at all? And this is where the middle way comes in. This is Nagarjuna's genius. He's not just a demolition expert. He's showing us a path between two extremes that have trapped philosophers for millennia. Look at the first point, avoiding nihilism. The middle way rejects nihilism, the extreme view that denies all existence and meaning. This is crucial. When Nagarjuna says things are empty of inherent existence, he is not saying they don't exist at all. That would be nihilism, the view that nothing is real, nothing matters, everything is meaningless. And that's just as much an extreme position as the opposite. Think about it. If you say nothing exists, you've just made an absolute claim about reality. You've said, the absolute truth is that there is no absolute truth. That's self-contradicting. Plus, it's just obviously false. You stub your toe, you feel pain. You eat food, you stop being hungry. Conventional reality functions, causes produce effects, things happen. Nagarjuna isn't denying any of that. He's just saying that the way things exist is not the way we normally think they exist. They exist dependently, relationally, conditionally, not independently, substantially, absolutely. Now look at point two, avoiding eternalism. It equally rejects eternalism, the belief in fixed, permanent existence and unchanging essences. This is the other extreme. Eternalism says things really do have permanent essences, unchanging natures, independent existence. This is the view that says there's a permanent soul, an unchanging God, eternal substances underlying reality. And we've already seen Nagarjuna's critique of this. It collapses under logical scrutiny. But here's what's interesting. Most philosophical and religious traditions fall into one of these two extremes. Either they're eternalist, there are permanent things, unchanging truths, fixed essences, or they're nihilist. Nothing really exists, it's all illusion, nothing matters. And Nagarjuna says, you're both wrong, and you're both wrong in the same way. You're both making absolute claims about the nature of existence. You're both clinging to extreme positions. Look at point three, transcending duality. Emptiness reveals a middle path that transcends the extremes of being and non-being entirely. This is profound. We're so used to thinking in binary terms. Either something exists, or it doesn't. Either it's real, or it's not. Either it has essence, or it doesn't. True or false. Being, or non-being. But Nagarjuna is showing us that this binary itself is the problem. Things don't exist in the absolute sense, but they also don't not exist in the absolute sense. They arise dependently. They're empty of inherent existence, but full of conventional existence. They're neither purely being nor purely non-being. It's like asking, is a wave separate from the ocean or not? Well, it's not separate. It's made of ocean water. It arises from the ocean. It returns to the ocean. But it's also not identical. You can point to a wave. You can surf on a wave. Waves have characteristics that the ocean as a whole doesn't have. The question itself assumes a false dichotomy. That's the middle way, not a compromise between extremes, not a wishy-washy, both are kind of right. It's a transcendence of the entire framework that creates the extremes in the first place. And look at point four, living wisdom. This flexible, non-dogmatic approach provides both philosophical foundation and practical guidance for ethical conduct and spiritual liberation. Because here's the thing, this isn't just abstract philosophy. This is about how you live. When you understand the middle way, you can engage fully with conventional reality. You can make plans, have relationships, pursue goals, make ethical choices, without clinging to the illusion that any of it has fixed, permanent, independent existence. You can care deeply about things without being attached to them. You can act ethically without believing in absolute, unchanging moral laws. You can love people without needing them to be permanent, unchanging selves. You can live with passion and purpose while understanding that everything is empty of inherent existence. That's the middle way, and that's why it's not just philosophically sophisticated, it's practically liberating. Now let's talk about what happened after Nagarjuna, because ideas this powerful don't just stay in one place or one time. They spread. They evolve. They transform entire intellectual traditions. Look at point one, Tibetan Buddhism. Madhyamaka philosophy became the cornerstone of Tibetan Buddhist philosophical training and debate traditions. When Buddhism entered Tibet in the 7th and 8th centuries CE, it brought with it the entire apparatus of Indian Buddhist philosophy. And guess what became the foundation of Tibetan monastic education? Madhyamaka. Nagarjuna's Middle Way Philosophy. To this day, if you go to a Tibetan monastery, you'll find monks engaged in formal philosophical debate, and a huge portion of that debate centers on Madhyamaka concepts. They memorize Nagarjuna's verses. They study the commentaries. They spend years, sometimes decades, working through the implications of emptiness and dependent origination. This isn't just historical curiosity. This is living philosophy, being practiced and debated right now, today, in monasteries across Tibet, India, Nepal, and frankly, around the world. Point 2. East Asian traditions. Profoundly influenced Chinese, Korean, and Japanese Buddhism, shaping Zen and other contemplative schools. When Madhyamaka philosophy entered China, it encountered a completely different intellectual culture. Taoism, Confucianism, Chinese language, and thought patterns. And something remarkable happened. The ideas transformed and were transformed. Zen Buddhism, or Chan in Chinese, is deeply influenced by Madhyamaka thought. That famous Zen emphasis on non-duality, on transcending conceptual thinking, on sudden enlightenment beyond words and letters, that's Nagarjuna's middle way filtered through Chinese and Japanese culture. Those paradoxical Zen koans, what is the sound of one hand clapping? They're doing the same thing Nagarjuna did with his logical analyses. They're breaking down our attachment to fixed concepts and dualistic thinking. Point 3. Diverse interpretations. Inspired numerous commentarial traditions whilst consistently emphasizing emptiness and dependent origination as central themes. And here's what's fascinating. Nagarjuna's philosophy has been interpreted in different ways by different schools. Some emphasize the logical, analytical aspects. Others emphasize the meditative, experiential aspects. Some see it as primarily negative, what reality is not. Others see it as positive, what reality actually is. But through all these interpretations, the core themes remain emptiness, dependent origination, the middle way. These aren't just add-ons to Buddhist philosophy, they are Buddhist philosophy for huge swaths of the tradition. Point 4. Contemporary relevance. Continues to influence modern philosophy, ethics, cognitive science, and debates on causality, identity, and consciousness. Now here's where it gets really interesting for us, here, now, in the 21st century. Nagarjuna's ideas are showing up in unexpected places. Cognitive scientists studying the self are finding that there isn't one. Not in the way we think. Consciousness appears to be a process, not a thing. There's no central self running the show, just interconnected processes arising dependently. Sound familiar? Physicists studying quantum mechanics are finding that particles don't have fixed properties independent of observation and measurement. Reality at the quantum level is relational, contextual, dependent on conditions. The universe looks a lot more like Nagarjuna's vision than like classical substance metaphysics. Environmental ethicists are using concepts of interdependence and emptiness to argue for ecological responsibility. If everything is interconnected, if nothing exists independently, then harming the environment is harming ourselves. The boundaries we draw between self and other, between human and nature, they're conventional, not absolute. Philosophers working on personal identity, on the nature of causation, on the problem of consciousness, they're finding that Nagarjuna asked these questions 1,800 years ago and offered answers that are still philosophically sophisticated and relevant. Point 5. Timeless guide. Regarded as an enduring framework for overcoming suffering through wisdom and insight into reality's true nature. But ultimately, for all the academic interest, for all the scholarly debates and contemporary applications, Nagarjuna's philosophy comes back to this. It's a guide for liberation from suffering. Not suffering in the sense of occasional pain or sadness. That's part of life. But suffering in the sense of that fundamental dissatisfaction, that existential anxiety that comes from clinging to what cannot be clung to, from trying to make permanent what is impermanent, from seeking security in a universe that is fundamentally insecure. When you understand emptiness, really understand it, not just intellectually but experientially, you stop fighting reality. You stop trying to freeze the flow. You stop clinging to fixed identities and permanent substances, and in that release there's freedom, there's peace. Not because you've escaped reality, but because you've finally aligned yourself with how reality actually is. That's why Nagarjuna's influence endures. Not because he had clever arguments, though he did. not because he founded a school, though he did, but because he offered a path to genuine liberation through genuine wisdom. And that never goes out of style. Okay, I want you to really look at this image for a moment, because sometimes, after all the logical arguments and philosophical terminology, you need to just see it. Visualize what we're actually talking about. Look at this network. What do you see? Points connected by lines, right? An interconnected web. But here's the question. Where is the thing in this image? Point to the entity that exists independently. You can't, because there isn't one. Every single point in this network exists only in relation to other points. Remove the connections, and you don't have points anymore. You have nothing. The points are the connections. The connections are the points. Look at the caption. Nothing exists independently. This isn't just a philosophical claim. This is a visual representation of dependent origination. This is what reality looks like when you strip away our conceptual overlays, our habit of seeing separate, independent things. The text here says this visualization captures the essence of dependent origination, an interconnected web of causes and conditions with no fixed nodes or independent entities. Let that sink in. No fixed nodes, no independent entities. Each point exists only in relationship to countless others. And here's what's beautiful and maybe a little unsettling. You can't find the boundary. Where does one thing end and another begin? The lines blur. The distinctions are conventional, not absolute. Think about your own life for a moment. You probably think of yourself as a distinct individual, right? Separate from other people, from the environment, from the past and future. But look at this web and ask yourself, is that actually true? Your body is made of food you've eaten, which came from plants and animals, which came from soil and water and sunlight. Your thoughts are shaped by language you learned from others, experiences you had in relationship, cultural conditioning you absorbed. Your emotions arise in response to situations, to other people, to memories. Your very sense of self is constructed from narratives told to you and about you. Where in this web is the independent you? You're not separate from the web. You are a pattern in the web, a temporary configuration of relationships and processes. And that's not depressing. That's liberating, because it means you're connected to everything. Look at this next part. The absence of a center or foundation reflects Nagarjuna's insight that there is no ultimate ground of being, no first cause from which all else flows. This is where it gets really interesting. We're so used to hierarchical thinking, we want foundations, first principles, ultimate grounds. We want to say this is the bottom level, this is what everything else rests on. But look at this web. Where's the center? Where's the foundation? There isn't one. It's not that we haven't found it yet. It's that the very concept doesn't apply. Reality doesn't have a foundation because reality isn't a building. It's a web. It's process. It's relationship all the way through. And here's the final insight from this visualization. Instead, reality is a dynamic, flowing network of mutual conditioning, everything supporting everything else. Everything supporting everything else, not one thing supporting everything, not a hierarchy with something at the top or bottom, mutual conditioning, mutual dependence, mutual arising. This is what emptiness looks like, not a void, not nothingness, but this vibrant, dynamic, interconnected web where nothing exists independently, but everything exists in relationship. All right, so we've covered a lot of ground here. We've looked at Nagarjuna's life, or the lack of biographical detail about it. We've examined his core text, the Mula Madhyamaka Karika. We've wrestled with emptiness and dependent origination. We've seen his critique of substantialism and his articulation of the middle way. We've traced his influence across cultures and centuries. Now let's bring it home. What does all this mean? Why does it matter? Look at point one, questioning assumptions. His philosophy invites us to question our deepest assumptions about self, reality, and the nature of existence itself. And this, I think, is the first gift Nagarjuna gives us. He shows us that our most basic assumptions, things we've never even thought to question, might be wrong. Not wrong in a trivial way, but fundamentally deeply wrong. We assume things have essences. We assume causation is straightforward. We assume we have a permanent self. We assume reality is made of independent substances. And Nagarjuna says, have you actually examined these assumptions? Have you tested them? Because when you do, they fall apart. This is philosophy at its best, not giving you answers to memorize, but teaching you to question what you thought you knew, making you uncomfortable with your certainties, opening up space for genuine inquiry, and in our current moment, where we're bombarded with people claiming absolute certainty about everything, where nuance is treated as weakness, where complexity is reduced to soundbites. This invitation to question our deepest assumptions feels more relevant than ever. Point 2. Liberation through insight. Emptiness offers liberation not through belief, but through direct insight into the interdependent nature of all phenomena. Notice what Nagarjuna is not saying. He's not saying believe in emptiness and you'll be saved. He's not offering a doctrine to accept on faith. He's offering a method of investigation that leads to direct insight. You don't have to believe that things are empty of inherent existence. You can examine them yourself. Look at causation. Look at the self. Look at any phenomenon you claim has independent existence. Follow the logic, see what you find, and when you see it, when you really see the emptiness and interdependence of all things, that seeing itself is liberating. Not because you now have the correct belief, but because you've stopped clinging to what cannot be clung to. That's a very different model of liberation than most religious or philosophical systems offer. It's not about being saved by something external. It's about seeing through your own delusions. It's insight, not faith. Understanding, not belief. Point 3. Philosophical tool. The middle way remains a powerful methodology for rigorous philosophical inquiry and personal transformation. And here's something I want to emphasize. Nagarjuna's method is still useful, even if you don't accept all his conclusions. The way he analyzes concepts, the way he exposes contradictions, the way he avoids extreme positions, these are tools you can use in any philosophical investigation. Want to analyze a political ideology? Use Nagarjuna's method. Does it fall into extremes? Does it assume fixed essences or absolute categories? Does it collapse under logical scrutiny? Want to examine your own beliefs about ethics or consciousness or meaning? Apply the middle way. Are you clinging to eternalist views, assuming something permanent and unchanging? Or nihilist views, denying existence and meaning altogether? Or is there a middle path that transcends both extremes? This isn't just ancient Buddhist philosophy. This is a living methodology for clear thinking and genuine inquiry. And finally, point 4, living with wisdom. Nagarjuna's thought challenges us to live with openness, compassion, and wisdom, releasing fixed views whilst engaging fully with life. And this is where the rubber meets the road. Because ultimately, philosophy isn't just about what you think, it's about how you live. If you really understand emptiness and interdependence, how does that change your life? Well, you might be more open because you're not clinging to fixed views about how things should be. You might be more compassionate because you understand that the boundaries between self and other are conventional, not absolute. You might be wiser because you're seeing reality more clearly, without the distortions of eternalist or nihilist thinking. But here's the paradox, and Nagarjuna loves paradoxes. Understanding emptiness doesn't mean withdrawing from life. It means engaging more fully because you're no longer paralyzed by attachment and aversion. You can act without clinging to outcomes. You can care without demanding permanence. You can love without possessing. You can live with passion and purpose while understanding that everything is empty of inherent existence. In fact, you can only live fully when you understand this, because you're no longer fighting against the nature of reality. So here's my challenge to you. Don't just accept what Nagarjuna says. Don't just memorize these concepts for an exam. Actually investigate. Look at your own experience. Examine your assumptions about self and reality. See if you can find anything that exists independently, that has a fixed essence, that isn't arising in dependence on countless conditions. And if you can't find it, if you see the emptiness and interdependence that Nagarjuna is pointing to, then ask yourself, how does this change how I live? How does this change how I relate to myself, to others, to the world? Because that's the real test of philosophy. Not whether it's clever or sophisticated, though Nagarjuna is certainly both. But whether it transforms how you understand and engage with reality, whether it liberates you from suffering, whether it opens you to wisdom and compassion. And by that measure, Nagarjuna's philosophy, nearly 2,000 years after he articulated it, remains as powerful, as challenging, and as relevant as ever. The second Buddha, indeed. Thank you.